Thank you so much, Patrick, for coming on the show today. I really appreciate you taking the time. When I first set out and did the podcast, you know, I have a few areas of interest from crypto to life extension and city building, and had you right at the top of my list in the city building category of people I'd love to have on. And I know you do a lot of work in crypto as well. So really an awesome guest and a pleasure to be talking with you today. Your background, I know, you know, you spent about a decade at Google, founded the Seasteading Institute in 2008 with funding from Peter Thiel. Now, I think you're probably most focused as a founder and general partner at Pronomos Capital. But it would be great for those who aren't maybe familiar if you could just kind of connect some of those experiences and walk us through your background and your story a little bit.
Yes, sure. I'm happy to do that. And it does sort of all connect. I guess after college, I started thinking about where I wanted to live and just realizing that the U.S. as a libertarian, the U.S. just really was not according to my values. And just as a consumer of government services, like the quality was kind of just way lower than what I get everywhere else. You know, I like to joke that like all I want is like a government that works as well as T-Mobile, like has the customer service of T-Mobile. You know, I'm not asking for the iPhone yet, but in government, we don't even have that. And so I was like, well, maybe it's just the U.S. Maybe if I move to another country, it'll be better. And I kind of looked around the world and was like, yeah, there's some things that are better, some things that are worse. But like overall, there's not any country that I'm like really excited to live in. Like, what's going on here? And so I think a lot of entrepreneurs start that way with a problem that they have that isn't being solved, that they dig into and get excited about and realize that it's a problem for a lot of other people. And that, you know, if there's a way that they might be able to address it, they get into it. And for me back then in the early 2000s, as I tried to, you know, I learned public choice economics and tried to understand kind of why governments are so mediocre. And at that time, governments were not at all willing to do programs like charter cities. And that's why I turned to seasteading, because we've often seen new forms of government evolve on the frontier, America being a classic example. You know, back when America was started, it was kind of a revolutionary new operating system for society that was based on the latest Enlightenment philosophy that a lot of people were skeptical of and thought the terrible things would happen. And it was because it was a frontier that they were able to start from scratch and you know, create this new system that's now the kind of industry standard of constitutional representative democracy. And since there was no way to do it on land back then, we looked at the ocean and said, well, it's really difficult to build on the ocean, but humans are much better at solving engineering problems than political ones. And if we can solve the problem of expanding humanity to this two-thirds of our Earth, we'll open up a new frontier. This will enable startup countries, and the kind of being able to try new things and the competition will improve the government industry as a whole. And so I worked on that for a while independently. I got my first full-time job at Google in 2004 and, you know, learned a lot about software and scale that really kind of impacted the way that I think about government as an operating system. And there's a sense in which a lot of my ideas are just the filling in the details on viewing laws as code and government as an industry. And so I worked on seasteading for a while, started the Institute in 2008. Then in 2011, Honduras created the first kind of independent zone program, the ZETA program. And I left Seasteading Institute, started a charter city company working with Honduras, but we realized after a year that it was just going to take them a long time to get this really innovative program off the ground, even though they'd changed their constitution and had the political will. It was just going to take years. And so I returned to Google, and kind of meanwhile, because of a lot of work from me and a lot of other people, these ideas really kind of spread, and countries got a lot more interested. Founders and investors got a lot more interested. The Honduran program kind of finally got off the ground, and starting a few years ago, about 2017, while I was at Google, I started like realizing that kind of the time had come. Like, we didn't have to build on the ocean. There's still some benefits to doing that, also some significant costs. But that we could start working with countries to do these semi-autonomous cities that will enable them to upgrade their laws, their operating system in a really a beautifully incremental way that really fits this software engineering philosophy. And so I started working on Pronomos, the first Charter City Venture Capital Fund, and that's what I've been mainly doing the last couple of years.
It's great. I appreciate the overview. You talk about how you look at government as industry and laws as code. It's really, you know, easy analogy to think about, harder, I'm sure, to start executing on and helping improve some of the code, as you say, and help the industry to develop in terms of government. When you think about, you know, governments, how most people view them today, I understand, you know, from your perspective, there's lack of incentive to be competitive. It's been historically quite hard to pick up and leave your home country or to join a new country and move to a new country and immigrate. The US, to your point, has been very successful in large part because it was the frontier and a lot of people could come here and there was a blank slate on which to create these laws. How do you think we can go from the place where we are now, kind of status quo, hard to move, governments don't have a lot of incentive to attract people from outside and to retain the people that they have and you know, give them laws that are most beneficial for them, to a place where there's more of a competitive dynamic in what you might call as like the industry of government?
Yeah. And, you know, this is something where I think those of us kind of working behind the scenes are feeling really optimistic. Like it's no longer a question of like, how can we figure out a way to make this incredibly hard thing of improving the government and industry happen? And how can we like convince people to enroll support? It's now more like it's happening and how can we make sure it happens well? And I guess, you know, in my analysis, where the important thing is competition between governments, and, you know, my basic theory is that you can focus on individual laws, like we should have this policy or that policy, and, you know, that can be good, but it doesn't work that well because our countries are mostly not machines for producing good laws. They operate according to very different incentives, which public choice economics documents, and they actually, in economic theory, tend to produce laws that benefit special interests and then hurt everyone a little bit. Like what we have is a world where even if you have ideas for new systems that will generate better laws, there's no way to put it into practice. And, you know, that's where seasteading and charter cities come in. That's what I think is really needed. And the exciting thing about charter cities is that, you know, a big part of the problem was the 0-1 of founding a sovereign city state. And charter cities are beautiful because they say, hey, we're going to start in an existing country with an existing legal system and work with the government to say, okay, here are the parts of the laws that you can rewrite. Here are the parts of the laws that we're going to follow. Here's how we'll deal with kind of disputes between us about what the laws should be. And we let people in the country opt in, like by moving there. And so it's like, the government, I mean, again, as a software engineer at Google, if you wrote some variant to the search algorithm, you didn't like write it and then like test it a little bit and then like deploy it to, you know, the billion Google searches a day. What you did was you might, you know, if it passed the initial testing, maybe you make it so that one in a million searches uses your new algorithm and you see whether it works better for those people. And if it looks good, you make it so that one in 1,000 people gets it and you continue scaling it up. And the bigger the reform you're making, the more positive impact you can have, and the more important it is to do it in this incremental fashion. And so it's charter cities are kind of this missing link between, you know, government as it was and starting new countries the way we start new companies today. And that's why I'm so excited and it's happening. Right. And I would just add, this is the very beginning of 2021. Like we've seen with COVID how all of these people are suddenly realizing they can work remotely, that they care about the government services they're getting and the taxes, which is the price that they're paying for those services. You know, people get all moral about taxes and they get all moral about government, I find it just much more effective to think of it as a product that you're paying for. And we're seeing governments around the world now competing for all these remote workers. I mean, here in the US, the Twitter wars with Mayor Francis Suarez of Miami, you know, have been fascinating. He's like trying to poach people from California. He's treating his city. He's the first Miami-born mayor of the city, and he's treating his city like a startup. He's out there competing with other US cities and states to bring in the best talent and grow his city. So, you know, we're seeing it happen even more so with COVID.
Yeah, it's definitely been an interesting accelerant. Funny as it may be, I actually recorded with the mayor yesterday and was talking.
Oh, wonderful.
I was talking with him about, you know, how exactly what you're saying, how COVID has made a lot of people. First of all, a lot of companies are remote only or remote first for the foreseeable future. And then people see that and they're working from home and they're realizing I actually don't need to be in San Francisco or New York or Boston or LA or whatever it is anymore. I can live wherever I want and work remotely and optimize for other aspects of my life, like living on a beach or living in the mountains or the woods or whatever it might be. And so it's very interesting as like a, you know, you talk about the importance of incrementalism in terms of going for charter cities rather than trying to reform, you know, the government of the United States all in one foul swoop or something like that. It makes total sense. And the concept of experimenting abroad in charter cities and then seeing what policies work and other countries can, you know, then see how they're working and why they're working and maybe start to implement them. You know, maybe if it's the United States, probably not one of the first to innovate in that sense, but they might do it on a state by state basis or whatever it might be. And you continue to have this kind of experiment and then incremental progress process unfold on a global scale and theoretically quite quickly if you can kind of establish that this charter city concept works quite well. You know, can you talk about some of the previous examples? We talked about like the recruitment with Miami today, and that's certainly one parallel, but there's also parallels of cities that have been built with kind of a charter city principle in mind. So like Hong Kong or Singapore. Can you talk about some of the existing examples that have already been done and what from those examples gives you hope that charter cities really are the future?
Absolutely. I would say that the main cities that we look at are Dubai, Singapore, and Hong Kong. And in general, it's also worth considering the entire special economic zone sector. For those who aren't familiar, a special economic zone is a geographic area in a country that has different policies than the rest of the country. Typically, these policies are small changes having to do with things like taxes and tariffs and export laws that enable certain industries. There are thousands of these SEZs, and they've been critical to the economic development of many countries, most notably China, which lifted more people out of poverty than the world has ever seen, using SEZs to gradually transform its economy. And there's a sense in which charter cities are kind of extrapolating SEZs to the next level and saying, what if we created geographic areas that had even deeper reforms? Perhaps we could have quicker or more consistent or more prosperous impact on countries. And in terms of those three cities, so Hong Kong, it's worth noting that in all three of these cases, it was a country that ran the charter city. And we're looking at, you know, as part of being in the 21st century, at moving more towards public-private partnerships, where a company and a country work hand in hand to create this new prosperity zone. What's notable about Hong Kong is that it was this kind of zone that had simplified business-friendly British common law that was run independently from the rest of Britain, and it was in an area that kind of didn't have a good like legal operating system. And you know, there's lots of talent and trade and wealth in Asia, and having an area that just had kind of, you know, what in the West is industry standard property rights and contracts and a well-functioning legal system, created this incredible city where people could move and build wealth and produce their wealth and help their relatives back home. And, you know, just, it just grew into this kind of shining example that shows that it can be done. I mean, it's true that it was backed by the United Kingdom and obviously kind of imposed by force. And in the 21st century, it's not okay to start things with force. But the idea that, you know, that one British administrator, Cowperthwaite, could kind of create a prosperous zone that grew rapidly, you know, just by applying the best practices that he knew and bringing them to a new place, like, that is still relevant today. Dubai, what I love about Dubai is that it's kind of the premier example of this idea I suggested of moving from SEZs to charter cities by deepening the reforms. And when they created Dubai, they actually thought about it the way that I'm suggesting. That is, they were like, well, we want to create a financial center for the Middle East. Okay, financial centers really depend on having a good legal operating system. Ours is not great for this purpose. Well, what's the best? And they ended up choosing London. And they literally drew a line in the sand and they said, well, you know, we're still going to have our criminal laws and many of the laws of our society, but kind of all commercial laws within this circle are going to be completely different. So they set it up as a separate legal zone. They imported British common law. They hired retired British judges and set up an independent legal system. And they, you know, kind of the same way when you're building an app, right? You know, you choose your development framework based on kind of what's the best for the app that you're trying to make. And in Dubai, to establish Dubai International Financial Center, that's what they did. And that's the mindset we're trying to promote, you know, that I kind of came up with to governments worldwide, is like, look at their laws as a key part of their tech stack that needs to function well for anything else to work. And then Singapore, you know, even it was a conventional nation state, but it's just run really differently than other countries. They really think of it almost as a business. And, you know, I've actually compared Singapore to Apple in market cap. Singapore started a little bit earlier. It's a little bit bigger. They've saved more than $1 trillion, but it's like one of the only countries in the world that was actually run at a profit, you know, which is a crazy, crazy idea if you think about government. But then if you think about it as an industry, like, that there's like only a few countries that actually, you know, make money and are over time accumulating resources to help their future citizens rather than like accumulating debt that future citizens will have to pay. And so, you know, while they're a conventional nation state, not a charter city, they are basically the for-profit city state of the world. And I think that's incredibly admirable. You know, they've executed, you know, incredibly well. I mean, I say this as a Silicon Valley guy who was at Google from 2004, like, Singapore executed at, you know, world-class startup level. And that's extremely rare in government. And we want to work with governments to make it more common.
So you talk about the for-profit difference, which is obviously big, being run almost as a company, more so than a government, unlike almost all other governments in the world. Are there lessons to be drawn from that for the purpose of charter cities in terms of, you know, we don't have to go and maybe start from a completely blank slate? There's elements from Singapore specifically that we can try in, you know, a country in Africa, in a small zone of a country in Africa, that we can do as a charter city. And, you know, maybe we can put this twist or that flavor on it that's actually a little bit different than Singapore and see how that works. Does that, I guess, are there any lessons from Singapore that can be useful in making the first few changes that might be, you know, most sensible for some of these charter cities?
Yes, absolutely. Although I'll say that I think the most important thing is the mindset and the incentives. I mean, you know, you've got an interview with the mayor of Miami, for example, and, you know, he's clearly thinking of his city, you know, kind of like a growing business. And so I think that like the hard part is even getting to try, is getting governments to think this way. Actually doing it, you know, I mean, I come from Silicon Valley. So the idea of doing really new things and building big companies and finding people who can execute well and understanding your customers, like we know how to do that. We just haven't applied it to government. And so I think that that's by far the most important thing. And in terms of specific lessons from Singapore, I think what's so beautiful about them is that they're not libertarian and they're also not totalitarian. What you can see when you look at somebody who executes well and thinks in terms of high level strategy and trade-offs is that they kind of come to all of these different compromises and try all of these different strategies that don't fit into some simple philosophy, but that all come from, I want to make a great city for my citizens. And Singapore has all of these things that are a blend between kind of business friendly and low regulation, and kind of, you know, strong state power at in certain times and places when it's really needed. So it's just a really different, you know, it's like, it's so easy to think of there just being an axis and like, okay, either you can be like free or you can have a lot of different control and like safety. And like, no, actually there are like ways to get more of both if you actually try. The two specific lessons. One is the importance of integrity. Part of what Singapore did was they were very, very strong against corruption and for integrity. And their legal system was enforced very, very fairly. And they, you know, they made absolutely sure that that corruption was investigated and stopped. And I think that that's just I think that's essential. And one of the great things about a charter city is that, you know, it's really hard to change corruption in an entire, you know, whether it's a city or a region or our world, where it's endemic, because these ways of doing business where you rule in favor of who's most powerful or who's most related to you, you know, that they're part of a culture. They're part of how people are used to interacting. And, you know, if you want to change that, whether it's in the US or in Europe and Asia and Latin America, being able to start in an empty area and build up a brand new culture, I think it's actually doable. Whereas, you know, Singapore, because they declared independence and were kind of starting from scratch, you know, the US did this as well, were able to like dramatically reform the culture of an entire country, but that's really hard and really rare. And we're looking for repeatable ways to upgrade the governments of the world. And so I think that kind of starting empty and letting people opt in is key. Another specific lesson from Singapore is the way that the government invested in industries and companies within their country. And so when I talk about them having, you know, accumulated more than $1 trillion of wealth and essentially having a bigger market cap than Apple, a lot of that, some of that was by taking the money that they made and just investing it like any capital allocator in projects in the world. But a lot of it was the government had an equity stake in the success of their city state because they took their money and they invested it in the companies and the factories that were being built in their city state. And to me, you know, I like to think in terms of economics, like a lot of the problems of government are problems of incentive. Like if you do a great job as a mayor, okay, maybe you get reelected. Maybe you can become governor. Maybe you can become president. But mostly, you know, you don't have, and your office doesn't have like a direct financial stake. I mean, there's some in the sense that tax revenue, if GDP increases, tax revenues increase, you know, But it's kind of like that's one incentive loop and it's okay, but it's kind of indirect. And what Singapore did was invest directly in the economy that they were creating so that as the city state grew, as incomes increased, they were, you know, literal equity owners. And so I think that in in charter cities in the future, kind of having the people running the city, maybe the citizens as well, having equity shares in the anchor tenants in that city so that they kind of succeed together is important. And in general, just having better incentives so that, you know, the government officials and the savings of the government kind of directly benefit from creating prosperity.
It seems so simple that, you know, mayor, governor, president, whatever it might be, would want to, you know, do what's in the best interest of his or her people. But to your point, that's not often the case, and it is an incentives issue. I'm curious to hear your perspective on what existing incentives are, for example, in the United States. Obviously, re-election, to your point, is a large component, and you know, one could argue that there's issues there because outside of the presidential election, even within the presidential election, but especially in local elections, there's a very small percentage of the population that's actually voting. And so the sitting, you know, elected official may be seeking to appease or speak to the things that a very small group of people in terms of the total population actually wants. And they actually don't even need to be held accountable or like invest properly to achieve those things. They just really need to like talk about it and prioritize those things. You know, that's just like a very loose interpretation on my end of what some of the wrong incentives might be. What incentives do you see in terms of what's lacking from having, you know, elected officials act more on behalf of their people, like you see with Mayor Suarez in Miami?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is best covered by public choice economics. I'm a big fan of Mansur Olson, for example. But if you just think about it in terms of feedback systems, like one election every 4 years or every 2 years, where like you select a candidate, like that is a terrible feedback loop, right? You know, when I was at Google, I could write software, you know, test it right then and there, maybe it deploy it to a few live users and get feedback right away. Like as you're never going to make a great product if you like poll your customers once every few years on who the CEO should be, right? It's like, it's just ridiculous. And so I think that having a lot more feedback from citizens to the country, or the city is critical. And having ways that those incentives can be kind of like weighted or meaningful, right? Like when you cast a vote, it doesn't cost you anything and you're not really getting to declare the intensity of your preferences. You're not getting to give any like nuance or complexity. And that just doesn't make for good feedback. And so I think cryptocurrency is a place where we're seeing kind of the most innovation right now in different ways of delivering feedback from multiple stakeholders and kind of incorporating them and incentivizing them in decisions. And, you know, a lot of it is kind of too new to roll out to real world governments, but that's where I see a lot of the future work is happening. But if you know, democracy, I feel like I keep coming back to this idea of looking at government in practical terms rather than moral terms. And I think that's just absolutely key to making it work better. Democracy has this incredible appeal from an ethical sense, right? Everybody gets an equal vote and an equal voice. And that was a huge improvement over divine right by kings, you know, where a few powerful families ruled over everyone. It was a huge improvement. But if you kind of dig into the expected effects of a democratic system, you know, it's not actually to produce good laws. And, you know, and the simplest way to understand why is just to say, well, suppose that some special interest is lobbying for a law that will cost everyone in America a dollar, that's $350 million cost, and will benefit their industry by $50 million. Like that is a $300 million loss for society. If you combine the $350 million lost and the $50 million gained. But those laws in a democracy will pass every time. And the reason is that, you know, when I'm just getting to vote once every few years, like I'm not getting to express my opinion that I don't want a dollar taken from me. And like I can never have the time to research all of the different laws that are out there that might cost me a dollar. And so this general setup of passing a legal change that costs everybody a little bit and benefits a special interest. Democracies are just incredibly vulnerable to this type of attack. And if you look at America or Europe, what you see are societies where these kinds of attacks have been succeeding for decades, and they build up, and you get more and more laws that cost everybody a little bit but benefit someone a lot. And it's just impossible for us to have the time to learn about and coordinate and defeat something that costs us a dollar. And of course, if you're the industry or the company that's benefiting by 50 million, you know, you're going to have a team of people making sure that it happens. And that fundamental logic just plays out again and again. And so I think we need to move beyond the kind of, well, democracy seems fair, and say, okay, well, what are other fair systems that give people an equal voice that would actually pass laws that benefit people? And, you know, in my competitive governance framework, you know, this actually comes from my dad's philosophy and a section of his book, Machinery of Freedom, where he said, well, what if everybody lived in RVs, right? So that, like, you were not tied to your city at all, and, you know, or your country. And your country was like, we wanted to declare war on someone. They would wake up the next morning and the entire populace would be gone. There'd be nothing left except six generals and a journalist. and, you know, I think that this kind of exit and voting with your feet is an incredibly powerful feedback mechanism that we need a lot more of. And so, you know, that may sound kind of theoretical because we don't all live in RVs, but with seasteading on the ocean, you actually can move around cruise ships, which are as big as skyscrapers. So you actually can rearrange and vote with your house. And on land with COVID, we're finding that with remote work, people are kind of more and more mobile. And the more people are able to shop for a place to live, they're able to pick up and move if it's not working well. This exerts competitive pressure so that, you know, there are a lot of different mechanisms a government could use to pass better laws that actually benefit their citizens, but they're not even going to try if people are kind of stuck there. They can just take advantage of them. And the more mobile people are, the more that cities are competing and the more that people are moving, governments are going to have to figure out a way to kind of pass laws that make their city a great place to be. And so it's just a fundamental shift in paradigm from ethical arguments about political systems to competition and consumer choice.
Yeah, so one of the things that obviously serves a lot of friction for people looking to leave wherever they are currently is their job. And that's, you know, to some degree out the window with the way that COVID's changed the world. I think, you know, perhaps there could be some return for some industries to working in the office, but I like to think, you know, once people have seen the new world to some extent and become comfortable with certain advantages of working remotely, a lot of people will come to prefer that, and they simply as a group won't accept their company, you know, saying we all need to be back in the office again. So the job tie to where you are might have been the biggest and most recent hold on that a government has on their people, which, you know, they didn't even design, but it's just an aspect of living that you're tied to your job in a physical location that no longer necessarily is the case. Other ones, of course, exist, like your friends and family and everything like that. But we have FaceTime and, you know, none of these issues are like super hard impediments anymore to moving. So to your point, you know, it may become a lot easier to convince people to try new areas, and governments may be held a little bit more accountable for, you know, like we're seeing in San Francisco, if you're not pleasing your people, they're gone. Just like, you know, you mentioned in your dad's book, if you announce you're going to war and everyone lives in an RV, the RVs are gone. So it's definitely an interesting change, and one that I don't think very many people saw happening as quickly as COVID. People anticipated a shift to remote work, but maybe not in this fashion. When you talk about competing governance, there's, you know, I think the first and most clear, as we're seeing in the US with like Texas and Florida, the most clear incentives up front are like, you know, tax breaks, lower tax rates, et cetera. What else do you see as like the next lowest hanging fruit beyond that, which can attract citizens, you know, both nationally, but more importantly, internationally to some of these charter city special economic zone type areas.
Yeah. That's one of those things that I kind of leave to the entrepreneurs and to the mayors. I prefer to play at this kind of like meta level what do we need to do so that, CEOs of new city startups, mayors of existing cities, how do we need to change the mindset of the world and what tools do we need to build so that they're empowered to ask those questions and answer them and act on them and grow their cities.
So, while it's easier to move on land than ever, there was, you mentioned the seasetting idea that with floating cities that it's actually, the most mobile because everything is kind of aggregating and attaching, but then at any time you can kind of leave and just float on over to the next mm-hmm. group and the next cluster. It makes total sense to me that you decided at a certain point when you realized that countries like Honduras and others might be open to more of a charter city model, that was the best place to go initially. But is there, aspects of seasteading that, you really hope to head back in that direction once the charter city model is kind of established so that there may be added benefits, though it may be expensive today, that, 10, 20 years from now, mm-hmm. with certain advancements in technologies, seasteading is actually like a super exciting thing that's actually beyond charter cities?
Yeah, I mean, there's some key threads here and you kind of have to be able to really think strategically. This observation I made in the early 2000s about this, the different physical characteristics of land and the ocean and space. I mean, I think it is important. And when the engineering advances to the point where settling the oceans is possible, we're going to see ocean cities that are modular and reconfigurable. And that will fundamentally change the incentives, the way that governments treat a new factory today, competing to see who's going to host it, or in some cases, kind of fighting with their citizens about whether it's going to be there, like with the Amazon, that cities on the ocean will actually have to compete even to keep their existing property. And I think that will just lead to kind of governments improving much more rapidly and focusing on their citizens. And, and then most of our Earth is actually this different fundament, like a base medium with different physical characteristics. And part of what's exciting to me is that space, which is, 99.999% of the universe, it actually has that same physical characteristic even more so. Like on the ocean, you got to fire up big diesel engines to move a skyscraper. In space, you could get out and push if you're willing to wait long enough. I think that we will see that as we expand to these frontiers with this physical characteristic that allows like space itself or like constructed space to be rearranged, that we'll see them be much more competitive. But of course, almost everything right now is on land and probably will be for a while. And on land, what's interesting is how can you apply this same mindset? Like one of the great things about the internet is that it's more like this, right? You can just move your app from one server to another, from one country to another. And so you get this kind of competition and rapid development for all of the parts of our life that are virtual. That's only increasing, like more and more of our life is going to be virtual. And so you actually get competition there. And like you mentioned cryptocurrency earlier, like people are often coming to me and being like, hey, how can we do your idea kind of in virtual reality? Or like, how can we apply these ideas to cyberspace? And I'm kind of like, you don't need to. Like cyberspace has this characteristic and it's already much more competitive. Like the question is, how can we get these kinds of features on land?
So you mentioned crypto earlier and just now a little bit in your response as well. How did you come to discover and get into crypto in the first place? And how do you view crypto? Well, you said, it might not be quite ready today and governments certainly may not be ready to accept it and use it to its full capacity. But how do you view crypto as potentially accelerating, enabling, improving ways in which we can run with these this charter city concept?
Sure. So I got into crypto in about the year 2000. There was a project called Laissez-Faire City that had wanted to do a charter city back then. And they no governments were kind of willing to work with them. And so they morphed into this Costa Rica-based company that was trying to build an anonymous digital bank, securities market, and a variety of other things. And, you know, and they were too early. And the founder was kind of a bit of a shady character. He did things like commingling funds, his personal funds with things that were happening in the markets and people's deposits. And, you know, but I found it very intriguing. Like actually, they were actually trying, they actually had a community, they were writing code. I went down and spent a summer, with them, I think in 2000. And you know, I had studied cryptography. I did discrete mathematics as an undergraduate, found it really interesting. And you know, my dad was a sort of at the edges of the cypherpunk community and kind of engaging in those discussions. So I'd heard about it. And I did an analysis of the kind of the banking system that they had written and like found some security flaws in it and made some proposals about how it could be done better. And, you know, this idea is not in any way original with me. It was just kind of, it was around at that time, but part of the flaw of their system was that it was a single central bank, even though it was operating on public key cryptography. It had like a bit of a cryptocurrency nature to it, but it was still kind of a single entity run by one person. And I was like, well, look, you could use this same system, but have a whole bunch of independent banks that were verifying all of the transactions and maintaining the shared ledger. And like, maybe you have like a transaction is kind of considered approved if the majority of the banks approved it. And that was it. I didn't fill in any details. Obviously there's a huge amount more to happen. And this idea was not original with me, but it was kind of playing in the space then. Their project went bust because of this financial mismanagement and they were just too early. But I was just excited by the kind of potential of these new cryptographic techniques to change money. And, you know, because I've been devoting myself to charter cities, I haven't gotten deeply into crypto. It was actually one of these things where I kind of resisted it for a while. And in the last decade, I was kind of like, crypto is so fascinating that I know if I like get anywhere near it or start reading about the new developments now that it's actually happening, I'm just going to get sucked in. And so I actually kind of held off until 2017 and then started reading about it and playing with some ideas. I have this thesis of markets eating the world and cryptocurrency as essentially as a technology for enabling markets, where a lot of people they think of everything in terms of Bitcoin because Bitcoin was like this first use case. But I think about cryptocurrency in a more generalized way, where, you know, Marc Andreessen has this great thesis about software eating the world. Just the idea that there are like everything in our lives can be done better with software. Not everything, but most things. And the process of upgrading our entire economy and political systems and like everything that we do with software is a massive undertaking. Like we're rewriting the basis of our entire world. And that means it's going to play out over decades. And I think that there's something similar with markets, where there's all these things that we do that are kind of opaque and illiquid. And you can see, you know, what is Uber? They made a market in taxis. What is Airbnb? They made a market in hotel rooms. If you look at the unicorns, something like half of them are basically making markets in parts out of parts of the economy that did not have well-functioning markets previously. And I don't think markets eating the world is quite as universal as software eating the world. I think the scope for applying markets is more limited, but it's still very big. It's so big that for decades, you'll see, you know, hundreds of companies or thousands of companies founded every year that are doing some version of trying to create a market in some part of the economy that doesn't have one. And from this lens, cryptocurrency is a set of cryptographic techniques and approaches and strategies that can be used to make markets. And making money, you know, was just kind of the first application. But there are all kinds of other ways of using these same technologies and ideas to make decentralized markets and all kinds of things. So that's, I think, been my main contribution to thinking in cryptocurrency, is that viewpoint.
It's a really interesting perspective. Haven't really thought of it quite that way before. Can you tie it back, last question, to you know, charter cities and the work that you are doing, and maybe, I don't know if it's relevant, but was that in any part, you know, the contribution that crypto could have to experimental governance and charter cities, was that in any way a factor in why you started paying attention in 2017?
Yeah, great questions. So I think that there are deep connections between cryptocurrency and charter cities, right? You can think of charter cities as trying to make a market in government. And it exactly is a specific version of this thesis, which is that, you know, taking this part of our economy, and I would argue the most important part of our economy, it's the largest sector by spending as a percentage of GDP, is our governments. And we think about them in these very ethical ways. We're very tied to certain cities and countries, and they're just all of these reasons why they're not well-functioning markets. And the more we can move them towards being products that you pay for, like with taxes, and having people think that way and kind of making it easier to start new legal zones, making it easier to copy laws from one place to another, making it easier for people to move, the more it will become a well-functioning market and the better a product that it will create. And, you know, the money application of cryptocurrency is basically this private decentralized alternative to something that had for a while been done by governments, which was managing money. And charter cities are trying to create this private decentralized alternative to, you know, massive nation states. So it's very similar. And then even more deeply, a lot of what cryptocurrency is about is governance and incentives. The crypto world is where people are like Vitalik Buterin are thinking really deeply about, like, how do we make shared decisions that result in mutual benefit? How do you prevent it from being attacked or being taken advantage of? And so, you know, that's exactly, it's being applied in a different domain, but that kind of is the project that we need to do for our cities and our countries, is what are laws that will enable us to cooperate and make society function better and kind of produce more of what people want: health and happiness and prosperity and security. And so I kind of see crypto as being like the experimental lab for governance innovation. And it's not just a lab, because it's actually also an application and a, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars industry. But that's where the innovations, I think, you know, and our focus with Pronomos right now is not on like really new forms of governance. I think that what the world needs right now is just kind of dissemination of best practices, best legal systems to more and more places, and helping them upgrade to kind of the current industry standards. That's what we need to do right now. But when that project is well underway and we've built kind of credibility and trust that we can bring security and prosperity to people, it'll be time to start thinking about creating charter cities that have brand new systems of governance. And crypto is where we're going to get those systems, because that's where they're testing them today.
Yep. I think that's a very hopeful place to end off. So, you know, again, I really appreciate you taking the time today, Patry, and it was awesome hearing your perspective on all of these things. I think you're certainly one of the most interesting people to watch at the intersection of charter cities and crypto, and helping, you know, lead in terms of thought and actual investing and execution as well, across all of those lines. So appreciate you taking the time, and looking forward to seeing what's next. Can we just end off by telling people and pointing them towards where they can follow you in some of these projects?
Yeah, absolutely. So the best place to follow us is on Twitter. My personal account is Patrissimo, Patrissimo, and then Pronomos is at Pronomos VC, Pronomos VC. And on our website, which is pronomos.vc, you can find reading lists and a knowledge base and pointers to some of the other work in this space. And really kind of social media is the best place to follow us because this stuff is so new. There's not very many books and articles, and the stuff that's happening is happening fast. In our first year, we were kind of focused on setting up and doing deals and understanding the space, but in 2021, we'll have a lot more content. I'm probably going to start a podcast. And yeah, you'll see that's the best place.